Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm Jack McGuy. Today, Christina Younger and John Johansson will join us to talk about The Narrows, a collaboration between the Post-Contemporary Arts Organization and the Rensselaer Land Trust to bring to life a five-mile-long hiking trail in Troy. Then we have the next installment of WOOC correspondent Megan Marone's physics segment with David Borton.
Afterwards, we'll hear the first part of an extended conversation with activist and Black history scholar Tommy Weddington.
And later on, we'll hear from correspondent Lavonia Mallory on her recent trip to the 2017 Annual American Academy of Religion and Society of Biblical Literature Conference in Boston. Let's start off the show with some rapid-fire local headlines. In Cohoes, 5th Ward Councilman Steve Napier Jr. has agreed to drop his bid to unseat current Council President Christopher Briggs in the face of a legal opinion following a tie vote at the group's first meeting of the new year.
The Troy Record reports that fire departments that also provide emergency medical services are asking the New York State Legislature to amend the law so that fire departments' EMS costs can be reimbursed from a patient's existing health care policies. This is presently prohibited, though other ambulance services are permitted to do so. Many of the departments are smaller volunteer organizations that operate ambulances alongside fire trucks. While the number of fire calls has decreased in communities, the number of EMS calls requiring ambulances has increased.
As part of his 2019 budget proposal, the governor has called for removing abortion from the state's penal code. Abortion rights advocates see it as a critical move as concerns mount over a Trump-appointed Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade that would leave New York women and their doctors subject to the state law. Last year, the Reproductive Health Act, which would have permitted a health care provider to perform an abortion at any time if a fetus was not viable or a mother's life or health was at risk, passed the Democratic-held State Assembly, but not the Republican-controlled Senate.
James Taylor and his wife, Albany native Kim Hesburg Taylor, donated $10,000 to Albany Medical Center after a concert at the Times Union Center that was to benefit the hospital was canceled. The donation goes to the Pediatric Emergency Department, scheduled to open this summer.
Both houses of Congress voted Monday to reopen the government after a 60-hour-long shutdown, approving a resolution that, in the Senate, comes with a Republican promise to hold a vote on continuing legal status for Dreamers. Many Democrats voted no, including Senators Gillibrand, Warren, and Sanders, as progressive advocates complained that the Democrats had backed down without protecting Dreamers. The Senate measure provides a 6-year reauthorization for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. The Senate bill stipulates that senators will continue to negotiate a so-called global agreement on a host of issues, including immigration. If no new deal is struck before the February 8th expiration date, the Senate will then vote on extending DACA.
In his biggest attack so far on renewable energy, President Trump has agreed to impose tariffs as much as 30% on solar equipment made abroad, a move that threatens to handicap a $28 billion industry that relies on parts made abroad for 80% of its supply. The Solar Energy Industries Association has projected tens of thousands of job losses in a sector that employed 260,000 people. China and South Korea may opt to challenge the decision at the World Trade Organization, which has rebuffed prior U.S.-imposed tariffs. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Christina Younger and John Johansson join us now to tell us about The Narrows, a collaboration between the Post-Contemporary Arts Organization and the Rensselaer Land Trust to bring to life a five-mile hiking trail in Troy. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So tell us about your backgrounds and how you ended up collaborating.
Well, I retired from public service and decided to put my work where my heart was, which was in land conservation. And we're partnering with Post-Contemporary as a project very close to my heart because it is in the heart of Troy.
Yeah, and my background is in architecture, kind of land management and cartography. So moving down into South Troy in around 2008, just started looking at the land and sort of realized what was possible down there. I had been working on it for years, and about 4 years ago, at the urging of OSI, I really started to branch out foreign partnerships and got involved with Rensselaer Land Trust and the city. And, you know, we got together and really pushed it to where it is now. And we've made a ton of progress since getting together. So it's been great.
Yeah, it's been a good partnership.
That's exciting. So what is the proposed map for the trail? Where's it heading?
Yeah, I can run through that. Basically, if you go like from the tip of South Troy, the 378 bridge, if you're familiar with it, the trail would essentially start there, wind up along the Wynnetskill, and then down over the Postenkill and into downtown Troy through Prospect Park there. So from start to finish along those points, it's about 4 or 4.5 miles. There's also a spur trail moving up to the Stolisen property, which is a Rensselaer Land Trust property that would kind of spur off of there. That said, you know, that's the kind of, if you look at a map of Troy, because of the topography and the way things are kind of laid out, there's a ton of like amazing open space throughout. And I think there's a lot of other interesting potential projects throughout the city. So we kind of view ours as like a main trunk line and sort of where we kind of drew the boundaries. But I think there's a lot of potential for spur trails, connector trails, and other things to work in and into more of a network in the future. But in terms of the Narrows, too, if you go on our website, it's narrowstroy.org. That's N-A-R-R-O-W-S, troy.org. There's a map that's available there and a lot more information if you're interested.
Part of what makes the route that we chose magic is that there's waterfalls. There's history, very definite connection to Troy's industrial history and use of mill ponds and water power, as well as the magic comes from you're not very far from a heavily trafficked street, but you feel a million miles away because you're in a ravine and there's water and there's nature, and you don't really have to go very far. And that is part of how this route was chosen. That's part of why the land was still there, because it is a ravine. It's not a place where you can build a house real easy. But there is a magic to this route that you have to experience, and that's part of what makes us very excited about where it's going and having it connect. The first spur that will be built is the one that connects to our urban preserve, the Stolensen Preserve, which is in the Vanderheiden Estates, and so connects a number of different neighborhoods in. There's a community garden, there's a beaver pond that comes and goes, there's a really nice, it's nice being the end point and the entry point from several neighborhoods through our preserve into this larger trail network.
Yeah, I had this experience maybe 10, 15 years ago living in Oregon, and I visited this small town, and I remember there was a school that was located about a quarter mile through some woods from a neighborhood, and the kids would move back and forth to the school like between the, through the woods. And I think like ever since that, I've been fascinated by this idea that like, you know, all transportation necessarily doesn't have to happen like on the streets, you know, or like associated with the streets. So the idea that you could kind of go from South Troy to downtown through the woods, like on cross country skis or something, to an MPAC show is pretty fascinating from our standpoint. So,
yeah.
So Christina, earlier, moments ago, you said something about industrial history, and I don't think I've ever heard industrial history brought into a discussion of nature trails before. And I'm wondering what sort of precedents there are for this and how you hope, both of you, hope this project will differ from those precedents.
What the industrial history of the Wynnetskill does is opens up more partnerships. The Burden Works Museum, which is kind of at the entry point to the trail, has a lot of information about what used to be along this trail. And you can see some remnants of the old waterworks there. And you can see where the mill ponds used to be. And so it provides an opportunity to put a little more into the walk in the woods, where you can say, can you imagine what this looked like? And we've done a number of hikes through history as part of building up support for the trail. And it really does... does evoke a different time, just being able to see some of the remnants. And it does also allow for some more partnerships and to allow people who normally wouldn't take a walk through the woods but kind of think water wheels are cool might actually go on this trail. We think it'll be a draw for some people who normally wouldn't think about going in the woods.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it adds a kind of layer of interest, like Christina is saying. You know, you look back at the way sort of these villages used to be or these cities, like down in this area in the Wineskill, for example, at the time, you know, there weren't really trains or major transportation. So if getting from there to downtown Troy was really far. So in a lot of ways, this little area kind of was this little community. It was almost like self-sufficient relative to like today's standards. So, you know, typically when you're on a nature trail, you're kind of walking through the woods, looking at the trees and so forth. And that's a layer, obviously, that's, you know, beautiful. But I think also, like we're saying, going through the woods and really imagining what life might have been like back then and the kind of really looking at those historic land uses and how they overlap with the natural landscape and then how that sort of receded back into nature, I think, from our standpoint, is just fascinating. And certainly, you know, interpretive signage and work like that will be part, you know, part of the project as we move forward and, yeah, partnering with the Gateway on that stuff.
It sounds like there might be also kind of like a futuristic utopian idea here, too, in that the post-industrial world is so often thought of as a wasteland. And the idea that a post-industrial future could be a place of growth and nature is kind of a hopeful thing.
Yeah.
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 So,
we agree.
Yeah. So all this land where the trails are being built, whose land is this? Where'd you get it?
Yeah. Well, the Land Trust owns a key piece on one end, and the rest of it, the majority of it, is owned by the City of Troy. And it will, and the City of Troy is a major partner in the project. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple gaps it'll be on streets.
Yeah,
So it's for a short period.
Yeah, something like when, I guess we haven't specified yet, but the project's generally broken down into two phases. So there's sort of a phase one and a phase two. Phase one, the beginning of it will go from what exists as the head of the Burden Pond Preserve there. It has a few different names, but about 2 miles up to the Stalisen Preserve there. So that section is essentially all within our control. It's, I'd say, 80% owned by the city. The balance owned by the Rensselaer Land Trust. And then there's one or two lots that we have options on that we're finalizing. So that's pretty much, I would say, 99% in the woods. There's one little crossing where it crosses Campbell Ave and drops over. The whole trail, once complete, there's a little bit more street on Spring Avenue as it goes down the hill there. So I'd say the whole trail system is probably about 90% in the woods, something like that, with a few areas where you have to get onto the street to kind of jump over there.
Yeah.
Is there significant trail building or infrastructure that you're planning as part of this?
The biggest expense is some bridges.
Yeah, okay.
Some even pedestrian bridges run into some money because of water level changes and things. But we're well into design of that. The Chazen Engineering Company has been hired by the City of Troy through a grant from New York State Parks, and we're almost done with design and shopping for construction money.
Yep. That pretty much covers it. I think there are some, you know, if you look at a map of the city, there are some parts of the trail that already exist, like, for example, the Burden Pond Preserve, and they're kind of, we'll say, like, kind of informal trails in those locations that you can access currently. A lot of the project is to kind of improve those trails and also connect through areas that don't have trails so that it kind of can connect all the different sort of existing parks in the city versus having those sort of isolated. Bridges and crosswalks being the kind of main infrastructure along with trail improvements.
The main expense, definitely.
Yeah.
So in the future, what's the relationship going to be between post-contemporary and maybe the artists who are staying there and this network of trails?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly the organization, just to take a step back, the organization is a contemporary arts organization that has kind of a twofold program, the first being an artist residency, and then the second being like public exhibitions and so forth. So in terms of the residency, I mean, it certainly you know, would be an amenity for those residents, and I'm sure a source of inspiration. From the residents that we've seen in the past, typically a good percentage of them get a lot of inspiration from the kind of local history and the kind of local environment. So we expect this to be a kind of extension of that. We also hope to do some sort of site-specific artwork throughout the woods and the trail system too, which you'll see sort of be in later phases of the project. But.
So how is this being funded? Where did you end up getting the resources to put all this together? I mean, I know that a lot of the land, it sounds like, was already available, but the money for the bridges and that kind of thing, where's it coming from?
Yeah, it's kind of mixed. So to date, we've raised a little bit under $100,000 from kind of a mixture of public funding, private funding, and nonprofit funding, and so forth. So that's got us to a point where we're basically ready to go for the construction of the phase one, you know, including all those bridges and stuff. So right now, we're basically running or in the process of raising funding for that construction. We think if things go well, we should be, you know, that should be raised up by the end of this coming year with construction, hopefully by 2019. It's always uncertain, but we're feeling pretty confident in the plan, and you know, because of a lot of aspects of the project, it seems to fit really well into kind of state and federal goals for this kind of thing. So we're optimistic.
I was wondering if there are ways for folks who are interested to get involved or support the project at this stage.
Absolutely. Well, we have several work days planned already. We are part of River Sweep every May 5th, which is a major volunteer day for cleaning up the Hudson River and all its tributaries. And we've used that for the last few years on this project, specifically to pick up garbage around the Burden Pond Preserve and into the Stallinson Preserve, and being ready for trail preparation. There'll be another work day. There'll definitely be, if you like, the other thing is that the Stallinson Preserve has a fair amount of invasive species because it was a disturbed environment. And so we have, if you like to pull weeds, and we've got volunteer opportunities for that. There are two places you can sign up to be a volunteer. One is at the narrowstroy.org website, and the other is at wrenstrust.org, where we keep a whole calendar of volunteer work days. So there's volunteer work days. There will be opportunities to help with fundraising. There will be many opportunities.
Yeah, across the board. We have a kind of a list of ways to get involved there on the website, you know, thenarrowstroy.org there, you know, including ones that Christina said, and also just in general, keeping an eye on the trails, you know, as the trails get put in place, like if a tree falls down, we want to know about it. So we've got what we call like trail scouts to kind of keep an eye on things, to people that actually want to get their hands dirty and cut trees. And, you know, there's a pretty wide range of opportunities, you know, social media help, a real variety of things. So feel free to reach out.
What have you heard from people in the neighborhoods around where you're building these trails? Are there folks who you've met already who want to be involved? And what is that relationship like?
Yes. There's, the main thing we hear is, why does it take so long? Basically, why can't we have it tomorrow? Yes, there is a lot of support, in particular around the Burden Pond neighborhood and through the neighborhoods that it touches. Right. There is a fair amount of support, and we think as it becomes more real, there'll be more. Part of why we encourage people to go to the website and sign up to be interested, what we're going to be looking to form in the long term is a Friends of the Trail organization.
Okay.
It's hard to have a Friends of the Trail when there's no trail yet. But we're still gathering the names so that once there's a trail, we'll be able to do that.
Yeah.
I had one question. You referred to this a preserve, the name of which I'm not familiar.
Stallinson, which is
Where is that?
It is at the end of Vonderheiden Estates. So if you go off of Spring Avenue into a development called, it's a middle-class development called Vonderheiden Estates, there's a community garden there.
Mm-hmm.
The stream goes through there. There's some hiking trails. You can also enter it from there's a couple other entrances into it. We've owned it for about 5 years. It was donated by the land trust by the developer, whose name was John Stallinson, which is where the name comes from.
Uh-huh.
You can also find that on the map on the website, too, if you want to try to see it visually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else you wanted to tell us about this project before we let you go?
Don't miss an opportunity to come and see it, because it truly is magic to walk off Campbell Avenue, be in a ravine next to a waterfall, and see pieces of an old mill system. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah,
and if you haven't seen them, the waterfalls are way more extravagant than you would think. I mean,
yeah.
It's quite something.
Who knew Troy had such wonderful waterfalls?
Yeah.
Right. Great.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM Troy. Joining us now is WOOC correspondent Kathy High with some special guests from Nature Lab.
So for those of you who don't know, Nature Lab is the sanctuary for independent medias, or one of their sort of art and science combined projects that takes place in the neighborhood. And the folks who are joining us now, I think, are here to talk about an interesting topic, which most of us don't like to think about, which is combined sewage treatment and the problems that come along with that. So could you all just introduce yourselves?
Yes. So, hi, I'm Julia Kavicki.
I'm Olivia Golden, and I'm Anna Pfeifenberger.
And we're students from Skidmore College who are environmental studies students doing research on combined sewer overflows in the Albany capital region and in Troy as well. And so I guess to start with, we'll just talk a little bit about how we got interested in this topic to begin with. On a day like today, when the rain is pouring down through the city, you often don't think about where the rain goes. And in old cities like Troy, there are the sewer system is combined with the rainwater pipe system underground, so that when large rain events like this happen, all of the water gets pooled together into one system and dumped out into the rivers, into the Hudson River. And so it's a huge issue in terms of water contamination. These large events happen. Do you have anything to add to that aspect?
So in terms of how we became interested in this topic, is that combined sewage is not something that one often thinks about. And it's often not on people's radars, especially when it's something that occurs so frequently within the capital region. And so we're interested in kind of looking at what policies are in place to remedy CSO events, and especially given increasing intensities and frequency, how to address that and what the community knowledge is of such events.
The instances of these events is increasing, you said?
Potentially. There's been projections in other areas of the country and other countries where they are projected to increase. And so a part of our research is looking at creating a projection for the capital region.
And that's related to climate change, I would imagine? Or?
Yeah. So, yeah, we also have two other group members who are environmental science majors. So they're studying water quality, or they're examining water quality, and they're also doing climate change modeling to see how the patterns of climate change that are predicted in this area will affect CSO events.
Wow. So as far as this policy stuff that you're talking about, what have you found out about this area? What are the policies? How is this being dealt with?
So basically, there's this organization called Albany Pool, and that pools six communities, Troy, Rensselaer, Albany, Watervliet, Green Island,
Cohoes,
did I say Rensselaer?
Yes.
Okay. Was that six?
Yes.
So that's them. And they're all part of this organization, and they collaborate, which is actually pretty unique in terms of CSO management. So they've created this thing called the Long-Term Control Plan, and that is a collection of different actions that they are taking to mitigate the CSO events. So that includes like green infrastructure, so building like rain gardens, like storage facilities where they can store this water so that it maybe just temporarily, so that it doesn't overflow the system or overload the system, I guess.
Pipe separation.
Yeah, sewer separation is a big one. So like creating new systems so that the systems aren't combined. That's also very expensive. Anything else?
Well, just that some of these green infrastructure Projects have also been done in other older cities that also have combined sewers, like Philadelphia. And one of the things they've been finding there is that it's really important to keep in mind when you're creating these new like public parks and rainwater retention sites and greening the city to try to slow down the movement of rainwater, it's important to think about where you're creating those sites and how they're being created. And so as a result of what they've been doing in Philadelphia, a research study group developed something called the Green Infrastructure Equity Index. And so it's not only thinking about how you can do green infrastructure to reduce the like occurrence of combined sewer overflows, but also how you can do it in a way that's equitable and just for all members of the community.
Mm-hmm. So what are the risks of improper like implementation of these solutions? What sort of things are you trying to avoid as you design these solutions?
I guess just like having it benefit people who need it the most, or just like distributed evenly across like everybody, instead of being maybe toward people with a higher socioeconomic status, maybe just distributed equally so everybody reaps the benefits of these policies, of these projects, like these green infrastructure projects, or mm-hmm. whatever other mitigation projects there are. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's also tied into like thinking about urban hydrology and the actual ecology of how rainwater retention happens, because you do want it to, be having a physical impact on the movement of rain through the city, so that you can reduce CSO events, which not only have human health impacts, but also affect the non-human life in the water and the fish and the downstream impacts of people who might be using that water for drinking or for agriculture or other reasons.
So we're hoping sort of through our research, by doing surveys, by doing community workshops and presenting on this, on our topic, and the findings that we do have, creating a dialogue between community members and public officials who are creating these policies to make it more equitable, have them held accountable for the policies, look at different approaches, potentially looking more at green infrastructure versus sewage separation, which is very expensive.
Have you had any conversations with policymakers in this area on this topic?
We've had interviews. We hope to do that. We've done interviews with people who work for the government, but they're not policymakers.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And we have been in contact with the members of Albany Pool.
Yeah,
as
we've gone to. There's some public meetings for the Albany Pool mm-hmm. that community members can go to learn more about what's going on, what they're doing to manage CSOs. Mm-hmm.
The dates can be found on their website.
Yes.
Did that meeting give you hope, or did you think it was, what was your impression?
It was really interesting to see what projects they had been going over the entire year. They kind of, each community went through what they had been doing, the different sewage separation projects. A couple of them had implemented green infrastructure. They were talking about different funding. This was the last meeting of their year, so they were kind of going over the books and everything that they had done, but also projections for the next year and what projects and funding they would be receiving.
So. I was wondering, is there any focus among you three towards reducing sewage waste to begin with that might help with this? Or is it just you're taking for granted sort of the amount of sewage that's being produced in a given municipality?
That's not directly part of our research, but it's definitely one of the things that I think we'd like to bring awareness to, maybe, about maybe when, like Julia was talking about the note, there's this no flush map, or, well, it used to be a map. Somebody made a map for New York City, because New York City also has combined sewer systems in certain places, but Julia could probably speak more about it, because she saw it, but... So bringing awareness to that, when maybe you shouldn't, like, should, yeah.
Yeah, so just creating awareness in, urban communities that there is this intimate relationship between rainwater and between your own, like, human waste, and that they mingle together, and so that you might start thinking about when it rains, maybe that should impact whether or not you're, flushing the toilet more or less often, and like, creating this link between weather and your daily habits, I think, is... really important, especially as you think about your relationship between like yourself and your own home and the larger ecology that you're a part of in the Hudson River watershed.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting.
So what has been your personal like biggest takeaways from the work you've been doing at Nature Lab since you've been here?
Well, we're kind of starting our collaboration, I would say. We are really excited about the work that we're starting, and we're hoping to do maybe, we're hoping to do some workshops in the future, maybe a presentation. This is for our, it's basically like a senior caps or a senior thesis project. It's called their capstone. So we are working toward that. So we'd like to maybe present our research that we'll present for our capstone also here. We're working on things like that. Maybe also doing other like water testing projects. Yeah,
I think we've just been really excited by the sort of energy that's building at Nature Lab around being aware of water quality and hoping to build on that for future projects.
So what kind of, I mean, on a day-to-day basis, what is your research? What do you do at Nature Lab, out of curiosity?
We've mostly been doing interviews with different people all throughout the capital region. Mm-hmm. And then our other group members have been doing water quality testing at different sites along the Hudson River. So it's kind of a broader geographic reach than just Troy or just here in this particular area.
What kind of questions do you ask in these interviews?
We're asking about
general knowledge.
Yeah, general knowledge, things like that.
Plans, perceptions.
Yeah, another huge component of our research is distributing an online survey that we're hoping to get responses from community members to kind of gauge the general knowledge and hopefully also have like an educational component to garner their interest on the subject.
That's all really exciting. Anything else you'd like to add before we let you go?
I think just one more thing to add is that there are ways that everyone can kind of play a role in reducing CSO impacts or CSO events on a smaller scale, like building rain gardens in your own backyard or just sort of allowing for more plant life and more, vibrancy and diversity in your community can also have a wonderful positive effect on reducing the flow of rain through the city and slowing that down as well.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have you back again when you've done finished your research and hear the conclusions. Mm-hmm.
For those just tuning in, I'm Jack McGuy.
And I'm Jonah Moberg. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Up next, we have the first part of an extended interview I conducted with activist and scholar Tommy Weddington. In this series, we'll try to connect the dots between the historical Black liberation struggles in the U.S. and protests that are happening today.
Yeah, my name's Tommy Weddington. Been doing activism and scholar activism for the last, 4 years now. Getting my PhD at the University of Pittsburgh, and I study Black social movements, race, and politics, mostly focused in the United States.
Thanks for being here.
Of course. Happy to be here.
I guess let's just dive right in and talk about, we think of the civil rights era as being, you know, something like 1960 to the late 60s, and everyone knows about Martin Luther King and about the bus boycotts and all of that, but I think that the movement was probably actually more than one movement, and that there were a lot more splinters than people are aware of, and a lot more ideological nuances than people are aware of. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think we kind of touched on this last time, is that the what we kind of group as the civil rights movement were actually kind of known, I guess, commonly as the Big Four. So you had Congress on Racial Equality, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Southern Christian Leadership. It wasn't
conference.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm blanking. I was like, it's not a corporation. and then the NAACP. These are kind of what we kind of grouped together in the civil rights movement, which grouping them together kind of obfuscates the different ways and different places that those different organizations functioned and how they kind of had different strategies. So the NAACP was more of a kind of legal strategy, whereas CORE and SNCC were a little bit more radical direct action. CORE came out of the North, actually, and had a multiracial kind of focus, whereas the SCLC was much more homogeneously Black. And based out of the Southeast. So there's all these dynamics that are kind of overlapping that kind of form what we know as the civil rights movement. But, you know, to kind of say that there's this monolithic movement is just not true. And kind of just like a essentializing of what Black activism looked like at the time.
Yeah. So let's get into some of the differences and similarities between these groups. I mean, to what extent were they able to work together? And how did they do that or not?
Sure. I think that it's complicated. And I say that not as a cop-out, but to say even within, you know, a five-year span, strategies differed, campaigns differed. And so you kind of beginning earlier stages of the civil rights movement, you had Congress on Racial Equality, kind of had no foothold in the South, no real support. And then you have this kind of phenomenon where you would see the Congress on Racial Equality incorporate local Southern Black leaders into their ranks. And that kind of was their way of kind of gaining a foothold in the South. You also had coordination on campaigns. So the NAACP worked a lot with the SCLC. And so you had a lot of even physical kind of, what's the word I want to use, transportation and financing the transportation of leaders within the movement. I think Andrew Young, I believe, traveled a good bit around the Southeast, right, to kind of help with local campaigns. MLK came down to Albany, Georgia, you know, not to mention Birmingham, right? He was all over the South. And so you have these court kind of geographical kind of dimensions of organizing, as well as infrastructure within the organizations themselves and kind of ways of overlapping with what was happening in the South in particular, that really doesn't fit neatly into one kind of one organization. So it was more of four or five. And you also can't forget, local kind of indigenous activists and well-respected community leaders kind of all kind of working together and deciding what campaigns were they going to be a part of, how are they going to show up and give a speech, so on and so forth.
Was there competition between these organizations, or was it mostly a friendly multiplicity of ideas that worked together?
I think that there was definitely competition, not so much as in the kind of competition and say we want to beat you, but it was, you had a lot of disputes and kind of tension between strategies, right? So I don't know if your listeners are familiar with like Ella Baker. This is kind of a classic.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about her.
Yeah, a classic example of just differing strategies within Black organizing. You also had...
For those who don't know, maybe Ella Baker was one of the founders of SNCC, right?
Right,
and
right.
One of the people who sort of invented grassroots organizing as we know it today.
Sure, right. And to build on that, you know, the disagreements that she had with the other leadership in SNCC was exactly over the method of organizing and how to train and build sustainable leadership and who's, you know, kind of decision-making and institutional knowledge functions. And that, you know, it wasn't, I won't say it was, you know, hostile, but it created, you know, kind of two different paths that that SNCC could go down. You also had the same thing happening with the Congress on Racial Equality, kind of trying to figure out what's the role of white activists, you know, in the civil rights movement. You also had that with the NAACP kind of trying to focus more on the legal reform lawsuit route, using the court to kind of change legislation versus the more direct action route that, you know, the marches, the sit-ins, things like that. And so you have these abundance of strategies that kind of form the basis of not disputes, but, you know, disagreements among, you know, organizers back in the 50s and 60s.
As well as, I think, between the organizers and the politicians who were working with them in some cases?
Yeah. I'm not as familiar as with, you know, the role of establishment Democrat Party in support of the civil rights movement at that time. But I do know that there's always been a overlap and exploitation, I guess, not necessarily in you know, the worst sense of the word, but kind of political party, institutional politics, Democrat, Republican, whatsoever, you know, kind of trying to establish a line on a social movement, black activism, or incorporate certain black activists, things like that, right? And so you have a lot of black activists from the civil rights era, but also the black power era, do end up going into politics, right? And a lot of times they end up in the Democrat Party, you know. And that's not to say that that's good or bad. It's just to say that that's kind of like, you know, one aspect of the relationship to social movements and institutional politics that occurred at the time.
So I'd like to just, I think mostly just because the organizations I'm most familiar with, talk a little bit about the difference between SNCC and the NAACP as they developed. I know that Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee started out maybe a little more traditional in their aims and their approach, and then by the end wasn't openly and ardently kind of like aligned with the Black Power movement under Stokely Carmichael.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas the NAACP, as it developed sort of to the present day, it's now sort of, and by a lot of people, considered to be more or less like a relevant organization as far as, yeah, do you have any thoughts about that?
I think that, so in sociology and kind of organizational studies, there's this concept of what's called organizational isomorphism, right? And the idea is that you would have two organizations or a spate of organizations that kind of operate in the same area will all start to look the same and make the same moves. You know, what's interesting is that that kind of falls apart if you only consider the NAACP and SNCC in terms of they're both black kind of social movement organizations, right? Because you have these radically different trajectories. I think it has to do with, you know, the strategy of the NAACP was effectively, how do I want to say? The strategy of the NAACP was highlighted and I would use the word kind of solidified, right, in that era. And so the NAACP coming out of the teens, right, formed, I think, I want to say 1917. I would definitely say check me on that. But in the 19-teens, had been around for, you know, roughly 30, 35 years before things really start to get kind of heated up with the civil rights movement, the return of black World War II veterans, right? And so you have, they're at this point, they're kind of established and they do what they do well, right? They do legal reform and political, you know, politics kind of along that route well.
They were actually founded in
1909. Oh, I'm so sorry. And they're founded as a response to, you know, the lynching epidemics, right? It's kind of like one of the key organizations to respond to the lynching epidemics, right? So that's a different way, that's a different strategy and a different origin from SNCC, right? Who comes about like in the midst of the civil rights era, right? And not necessarily kind of founded as a response to the open violence of lynching and things like that and racial riots and stuff like that, but more of a part of the larger kind of political demands for, you know, legal reform, institutional reform into segregation, Jim Crow, things like that. And so I think that those kind of historical contexts and also, you know, subsequent difference in strategies kind of affect the trajectories of the organizations, not to mention who was involved, right? So you had a lot of younger black activists in SNCC, whereas you had a lot of the I guess, more established black activists. Not to say that there's an overlap, and then there's like the NAACP youth branches and all of that, but, you know, that's where the complication comes in, right? But the NAACP, I suppose, had a lot less flexibility relative to SNCC as far as the paths that they could go, right? So the incorporation of that kind of youth, youth energy, kind of younger activists was already predetermined in the NAACP. And you can kind of see this in how some of the NAACP youth chapters, I want to say that there's one in, I want to say it's Minnesota. I can't remember exactly which city, but they the youth in the NAACP also have this kind of decision to make of what do we do about the other civil rights organizations. We're with the NAACP. Is that really what we want to be?
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the NAACP as a response to lynchings and these kinds of like immediate, like physical crises. And then sort of moving into the next part of our discussion, it would be possible to frame some of the Black Power organizations in the same way, like the Black Panthers in particular, who were founded as a neighborhood sort of defense organization, mm-hmm. a radical Marxist militarized organization. So could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, sure. I think that what's super interesting about the influence of Marxist thought had saturated so much more of American activism in the early 20th century than I think people give it credit for, right? You have stories over and over of civil rights activists, Rosa Parks, they have pictures of her at these kind of Marxist influence kind of organizing spaces.
W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a glowing eulogy for Stalin.
Right. So it's kind of, this is not the influence of Marxism on, activist thought in the United States actually kind of predates what we know as the civil rights movement by some decades, right? Mm-hmm. And if you kind of look at the history of the people that were in the civil rights movement and where they come from, you have this kind of convergence of leftist kind of Marxist activism and then also kind of grafting over Black activism in a way. And so, what's interesting about the Black Panther Party, but also the Black Power movement or the Black Power phase of the civil rights movement, depending on how you want to do the historiography, is that it's simultaneously a extension of a lot of and maybe explicit enunciation of a lot of Marxist thought that had been, influencing activism throughout the 20th century, but also a response to the aspects of institutional and social racism that can't be legislated away, right? And so a lot of it is existing in kind of response to, de facto racism of policing, right? That, wasn't necessarily covered by the Civil Rights Act, right? By the what was perceived as foot dragging as far as like voting reforms in the South, right? So, what a lot of people kind of associate the Black Power movement with Black Panthers or think they're synonymous, but it's actually like Stokely Carmichael and Greenwood in 1966, right, is where that phrase comes from. Right. So it's like, no, this kind of Black Power ideology and this kind of banner enunciation is right in the middle of, the kind of, I guess, cradle of the civil rights movement and where so much activism had been happening for, over what, just under a decade before.
I think is it true that there's been an attempt to intentionally separate in the public mind this quote unquote respectable activist like Rosa Parks from the more dangerous people like the Black Panthers?
Sure. And that's what's also, I think, the difference between maybe kind of, historical research and people that have to, pass the screening of a press to get their book out versus what you can just go and say to your friends or what you can say on Facebook or something, right? The kind of traditional, narrative that we kind of frame civil rights movement and Black Power is, Black Power is Malcolm X, which is a whole other story that I'm sure we'll get to shortly, right? And civil rights is kind of MLK, and they represent the two poles of Black resistance, right? Black Power being autonomous and separatist, and civil rights being reformist and inclusion-based, right? And that's just not true. And that really boils down so many different strands of thought and kind of disputes within the civil rights movement, but also within the Black Power movement. And so, that's totally the narrative that we kind of are, spoon-fed during Black History Month, which is, 2 weeks away? it really doesn't pan out when you look at the connections that Black activists were making themselves, the influence of, prior Black activism, which be it Garveyism, be it the Nation of Islam, these things that predated the Black Power movement, but definitely influence and definitely those ideas carried over into it.
That was the first part of an extended interview with Tommy Weddington, activist and scholar of Black history in America.
Physicist David Borton is back with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. This week, he and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone traveled to the Ingalls Avenue boat launch to observe physics in action along the banks of the Hudson River in the North Troy neighborhood of the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
Okay, we are back, and this is a special investigative quality under the law, practical physics with Dr. David Borton. David, where are we?
So here we are sitting on the east bank of the Hudson, looking over some water and some ice and looking toward the west.
We are at the Ingalls Avenue Boat Launch in North Central Troy, and I find this place to be one of the most exciting places on planet Earth for so many reasons. What do you think?
This time we're talking about physics that you can see from sitting overlooking the Hudson River. So what do you see?
Well, we are looking at the Hudson River estuary. We have to face the truth that this is a super fun site. It's also the Hudson River estuary, and in our line of sight, there is so much. There's hydroelectric dam.
Okay, wait, stop. Tell me how that works. What's the physics there?
Water pumping into the station.
How does the water get its energy?
Well, turbines inside, right?
Okay, that's what takes the energy out of the water. Okay, so how did the energy get into the water?
The sun.
Exactly. The sun lifted up the water into the clouds, and the clouds made rain, and the rain was upstream from here in the headwaters of the Hudson. And so that energy now, gravitational energy, is now being used in the hydroelectric plant to convert some of that energy into electricity.
And who benefits from the electricity that is being made in the old hydroelectric dam that we're looking at?
I believe it's the town of Green Island that they get their electricity from that. And that's a very good source for them because it's an old plant, it's been paid for, and so their electricity is quite reasonable price.
So the residents of Green Island are not getting their electricity from National Grid?
I don't know the details of the connection. That essentially is the truth.
That's interesting. We can't really see it, but National Grid is actually right over there too, right? We have Lock 1, the first lock of the Erie Canal, also known as the Federal Dam. There's actually a ton of plant life around us on the shores of the Hudson. There are crows flying, crows walking on the ice down on the Hudson. Lots of brush,
okay,
snow
so
on the ground.
Let's ask, how does this brush look right next to us?
Straggly.
Straggly. It's probably dead, okay? It probably died in the winter. But now, what's this right here next to us?
A tree.
A tree. How does it look? Alive or dead?
Alive, waiting to bloom again.
Exactly right. So it's staying alive even though it's cold winter. And that's really pretty cool. That's a crow. I don't know details about crows, but you've seen a chickadee?
Yes.
Okay, I just found out recently that a chickadee in the winter when it's cold doesn't have enough food energy from the sun, from the grain that it eats, to get through a winter night unless two things happen. It lowers its temperature by about 20 degrees, and it lowers its respiration so that its metabolism goes down so that it actually has enough energy in its body to wake up the next morning.
I wonder if a crow or a raven works the same way, but we're talking about an animal that has a conservation of energy system.
That's right. If you go back in time, we're looking at these crows, what were their ancestors, let's say 65 million years ago?
The velociraptor.
Yeah, dinosaurs. Okay, so the dinosaurs are around, and actually just south of here, the dinosaur barbecue in Troy. So we're looking at dinosaurs in the form of crows.
This is getting weird. The dinosaur barbecue. It sounds like the place where dinosaur ancestors are being barbecued.
They're descendants, right?
Oh, yeah, descendants. This is a place where I spent a lot of time this past summer with the students of Uptown Summer, the Sanctuary for Independent Media's summer program. The students did water testing down here, and we also met with a woman who is the member of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohegan Nation. The Mohegan name for the Hudson is the river that moves both ways. So we're looking at a frozen, iced, and snowed over estuary. Water moves two ways, and that's necessary within an estuary. So do you have any physics comments on that?
Yeah, solar energy. Tides are related to the fact that the Earth is turning and the sun is in one direction. And so as the Earth turns underneath the sun pulls the water, which makes the tides that make the Hudson River flow up and down.
Maybe that's another reason why I find this spot so beautiful, is that Troy is the last place along the Hudson where the Hudson is tidal. I know some of the streams that are tributaries into the Hudson are also tidal around here.
Yeah, this is the farthest north that the tide comes.
Mm-hmm. So it's a beautiful, sparse environment. People still call this the boat launch. There isn't a boat launch here.
Well, 20 years ago now, a biologist, Carl McDaniel from RPI, and I brought a bunch of RPI students down here, and we got into rowboats, and we rowed down the Hudson River because he was teaching a course called 1 Mile the Hudson. And it was an ecological course that talked about the kinds of things we're talking about from a biological perspective. So we launched the boats here and rowed them down to Albany.
What kind of boats?
These were little rowboats, aluminum rowboats.
So you made those RPI kids work.
We made a fun day for the students. And then this summer we had, I thought it was a great day. We had some students who came up to Troy, got into the boat. This was the solar boat, Solar Sal. And we came up here to this lock and we watched boats go through the lock. And
that's right. It was you, Captain David Borton, taking the Uptown Summer students through Lock 1.
Yes, that's what we did. It was a nice day.
Beautiful, incredibly memorable moment because the Solar Sail just puts you in touch with the water in such a serene, calm, but also pretty intimate way. You feel like you're in touch with the river. So, well, I've been down here in the summertime and people have bonfires on this beach. Tons of driftwood. This is a secret driftwood spot.
Yeah, well, driftwood's pretty interesting stuff because some of the minerals get leached out. And it can dry very well after that, and then it burns very nicely. So driftwood makes great firewood.
So any physics to the human activity that goes on this beach? There's fishing down here. It's not recommended. You're not really supposed to fish, but there is fishing that happens here. Bonfires, the driftwood collection. Any physics lessons?
There's physics in all of them, of course. It's all powered by solar energy that powers the people. So bonfires are pretty cool. They're the sort of the opposite. We were just talking about living trees. And we talked a while back about the fact that carbon goes into a tree from the air. And when you have a bonfire, you're taking oxygen from the air and releasing that carbon back into the atmosphere. Mm. So that's sort of the opposite of photosynthesis in your bonfire.
Hmm. What else do people do here? I found oyster shells on this beach, which was surprising. Old pottery from the factories that were along this river. Old remnants of old canals that used to be here.
Yeah, all of those things are things that people have done, and people did them with solar energy from the food that they eat. So we're looking at a solar-powered world.
But always a great reminder, too, that the Hudson River begins as dew in the clouds up in Lake Terre of the Clouds and then trickles down to here. If the river itself were a narrative, this is where the story changes. You know, from here south, the river is tidal, and you just have the frenzy of a tidal estuary and the sturgeon that spawn here.
Well, the tides are really pretty interesting. If you're in a boat, you can float with the tides up and down and up and down, and the tides can be more than the current that's actually in the river.
This is also, for Capital Region listeners, a great stargazing spot. I know that. But it's also kind of a secret spot, so don't tell too many people about it.
Well, ride in a solar boat and go past it. The nice thing about a solar boat is, like, right now it's quiet and it's clean. Whereas if you were in another boat, you wouldn't be quiet and you wouldn't be clean and you wouldn't have the perspective that we have sitting here in a clean, quiet environment.
Well, maybe there can be a physics segment where we are cruising cleanly on the Solar Sail. That would be fun.
Well, let's wait until the ice is off the river, okay?
Well, thanks for the field trip.
Well, it was my pleasure.
That was local scientist, educator, and solar boat builder David Borton and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone with Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk magazine every Tuesday to catch Dr. Borton and his popular science segments.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm Jack McGuy. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on 6th Avenue in North Central Troy. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.